Hi, this is Wayne Randazzo of the WCBS Mets Radio Network, and you're listening to Baseball and BBQ.
Listening to Jeff and Len on Baseball and Barbecue, one of my favorite podcasts, and I know it's one of yours too. The only problem is, after I get done listening to it, I'm hungry. All right, guys, take it away.
Welcome to episode number 80, the big 8-0 of Baseball and BBQ. The BBQ stands for barbecue, and I am here with the New Year's baby, all grown up, Jeff Cohen.
Not quite Jeff. New Year's baby, but Leonard, how are you doing? Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year to you. I can't be more excited. Truth be told, we're recording this right before New Year's Eve, but it's coming out day after New Year's Day, and it's episode 80. This is a bonus episode, and this is a big bonus.
Yes. Who do we have?
Can't get much bigger. Well, in my heart, and you know in your heart, we have Howard Johnson, and in our hearts, he is definitely one of those players that we love.
Oh, Hojo. Right. Love Hojo.
Yeah, we do. We love Hojo. Okay, so the great thing about this interview that you guys are going to love is – nobody knows Howard Johnson as a pitmaster, as a barbecue lover, okay? Well, I don't know that he's a pitmaster, but he certainly wants to be one. And the funny thing is, we have him on to talk all about baseball, and all he wants to talk about is barbecue.
He is very enthusiastic talking about both.
Yes, he really is. He really is. And he told us when he has us over, we're not going to spoil it, but he told us what food he would prepare for us if he had us over. We're going to have to knock at his door one day.
Exactly.
Before I forget, I want to just make sure that everybody, I know the holidays are over, but if you have anyone that you forgot to get a gift for, go to baseballbbq.com for the grilling tools and accessories, and fifthandcherry.com for cutting boards. Those are two great companies. Just because the holidays are over, you know, now it could be birthdays, anniversaries, whatever it is. And Jeff, before we get to Hojo, you and I took a very special road trip.
Yes, we did. We, as you know, we live in New York. We took a little road trip up to Westchester County, and we went to the gravesite of two legends, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. Now, they're not in the same cemetery, but they're very, very close.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very, right across from each other, basically.
Exactly.
And we went there.
We took some video of it, so you can go to our YouTube page and check out those videos of our visit to Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig.
Yeah, we don't put a lot up on our YouTube page, but when we do put something up, I think it's good. You know, you'll enjoy it. It was snowy. Right. It was just after that major storm that we had.
Right.
Didn't stop us. It didn't make it too easy to find their graves.
Right.
but we did find them. Although we did end up in the wrong cemetery at one point, but we found them.
We found them. Yes.
And then it turns out that in those cemeteries, you've got some other you've got Billy Martin.
Right.
He's also there. And former Yankee owner,
Rupert Murdoch,
right, is there. It's real. I mean, at Babe Ruth's grave, especially, you were unearthing because they were covered with snow. There had to be 100 balls there.
There had to be. messages on those balls, other memorabilia, people really.
There was a letter from that 9-year-old boy who lives in Illinois.
Right.
That was there. And he was, now, that's how you know that these players are just basically immortals in baseball.
Right.
A 9-year-old boy writes a letter to Babe Ruth and tells about the pandemic that we're going through and how he's so disappointed. In his letter, he says there was no opening day. They may not have baseball. He's 9 years old.
Right.
And yet he knows Babe Ruth.
Yes.
Amazing.
Amazing.
So, what? Jeff, let's go right to Hojo.
Absolutely. We are honored to have on Baseball and BBQ a 2-time All-Star, 3-time top 10 MVP candidate, 2-time Silver Slugger Award winner, 2-time world champion, 3-time member of the 30-30 Club, and has played for 4 major league clubs, but is best known being a member of our favorite team, the New York Mets. We hear he's a heck of a grill master and a 1986 rib-eating champion. Welcome to Baseball BBQ, Howard Johnson, affectionately known as Hojo. Howard, thanks for joining us.
Welcome, Hojo.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate y'all having me on.
Hojo, a quick story first before we get started. We found out that you were a grill master. We have a friend who was in the barbecue sauce business. His name is Ray Sheehan.
Okay.
He was in a butcher shop one day, and he runs into a friend of yours, and he says, oh, you know, my friend Howard Johnson is a grill master, and that friend happened to be Bobby Ojeda.
No, so,
Bobby. Yeah, so that's how we found out you were a big barbecuer.
Bobby O's my man. He and I are tight. We've been friends for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Well, the funny thing is, Hojo, is really we have you on for your barbecue knowledge, and it just happens you played a little baseball. Really,
I got a lot more knowledge playing baseball than I do barbecue. Trust me. I'm a novice barbecuer, although I've been at it for a few years now. And I got a few recipes that are down pat, so I'm pretty happy about a few things.
Well, we will definitely get to barbecue. I think though, Jeff's going to start us off. Let's go, Jeff.
Okay.
We've got Hojo.
And, yes.
If we could be fans for just one moment, and I know you have to act like you've been there, right? They say act like you've been there, but being big fans of the Mets. We are thrilled to have you on. I just have to tell you that.
Well, it's a pleasure for me, too. I appreciate you guys having me on.
Thank you.
I can tell you that in 1984, I was 22 years old, and I was an intern working with Jay Horowitz in the public relations department.
Wow.
It was only a one-year thing, but the assistant PR director, Dennis D'Agostino, who I'm sure you know,
oh, yeah.
He kept saying, you know, the Mets are going to get Hojo. They really love Hojo, and the following season they got you. You spent 3 years in Detroit playing for Sparky Anderson. How was playing for Sparky?
Well, playing for Sparky was a challenge at times. He wasn't necessarily the most patient guy with young players, but I did learn a lot from the man and the coaches there. We had a heck of a team while winning the championship in 84, and I had a lot of really solid teammates that I learned a lot from and really, really enjoy hanging out those years with them. And guys like Trammell and Gibson and, you know, just spending time watching them prepare every day really helped me when I got to New York.
Now, Hojo, you're from Florida. So
yes.
The Yankees draft you before Detroit drafts you.
Yes.
But being from Florida, were the Yankees such a big deal to you then that you were drafted by them?
No, not like you know, the whole New York baseball scene, I guess, really didn't impact me much down there. I was – the Phillies had spring training in Clearwater. So I spent a little time watching the Phillies, you know, spring train and watch their games. And I'd see teams come in and, you know, I listened to Harry Callis on the radio, Phillies games. The Braves were on TV maybe like once a week. So I got to watch them a little bit. And of course you had the Cubs in WGN that was on all the time too. So yeah, I'd say more of my baseball upbringing was more nationally leaning. And you know, the New York baseball teams at that time were good, obviously, with the Yankees. The Mets were pretty good. When I was a really young kid, I used to like Oakland. And that was just about the time they were winning all those championships. I loved the uniform and Reggie Jackson and all the guys that they had at that time. And I just remember them beating the Mets. And, you know, coming home from school early to get to watch an afternoon World Series game was the best. And I remember watching them play the Mets and So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of weird that I ended up passing up on the Yankees going, you know, I ended up going to the Detroit Tigers.
Right. So when you were a kid and you're, you know, as we all did, you had a player and you would practice that batting stance.
Yeah.
Who was the player whose stance you would pretend you were?
Well, I was although I liked Oakland, I liked all of baseball, period. But I used to like watch Rod Carew hit. You know, he always had that stance where his hands were real loose and the bat was kind of like flat and, you know, the guy could flat out hit. And I used to watch Pete Rose. I used to watch all those guys back in the day. Whoever was on television, I would watch. Not like today where you got like, you know, during a season, you've got every single game on, you know, at your disposal. Back then it was one game a week, usually the Saturday game of the week. Tony Kubek and Joe Graziola, that was all we had. And then occasionally you'd have a Braves game for us. And, of course, the Phillies were on the radio. So, you know, you get to see as many different guys as you do now.
You were traded to the Mets in 85 for the 85 season. Did you know how much they wanted you, and were you excited to come to New York?
I was. Well, I got the call from Bill LaJoy, who was the general manager with the Tigers, and he said, Hojo, we had to trade you. And this is the last day of the winter meetings. I was down in Florida, and I remember I woke up, it was early Sunday morning, and he said, we traded you last night. And I said, okay. Well, he didn't want to do it, he said, but Sparky, they were looking for starting pitching. The Mets had a little bit of it, so – and the Mets were looking for a guy that could play third base, possibly be their everyday guy. And so it was kind of a natural fit. And I appreciated, you know, the honesty from my general manager. And then my next phone call was from Jay Horowitz. So when I found out, you know, I was with the Mets, I was extremely excited because I'd met Davey Johnson before. Kind of like I said, the National League was kind of a, you know, where my attention was drawn the most. And so I was looking forward to the opportunity.
The Mets were in the process of trading Yubi Brooks, of course, to get Gary Carter. So it all made sense. You come to play third base. Of course, the Mets had Ray Knight, so I guess you platooned with Ray.
Yeah, yeah. But when I came over, Davey, it was a straight platoon, Ray and myself. And, you know, Davey found ways to use me in different ways. And it was awesome because he kind of used all of my abilities, things I could do to help the team. And that year we had a really strong ball club and we got Carter. And so, you know, a lot of things happened, you know, in our favor, and we almost won it.
Oh, you were in it every year from 84, actually, through 89 or so. I know you were on that 92 team, the worst team money can buy. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
But 85, 86, I mean, you quickly became a fan favorite. I mean, you are top 10 Mets categories even to this day. That's fantastic.
Well, I appreciate that. I played 9 years, ended up playing 9 years for them and put up some numbers. I had a good 5-year career in there. So I had a 5-year span where I was pretty good. And three of those years were really good. And the fans are an integral part of what, you know, how you prepare to play in New York City. You know, you can't run from them. You gotta appreciate them. And all they want is guys to play hard. And so I learned that early. And if you acknowledge them and you play hard and you give everything you have, then they'll appreciate it whether you win or lose. But, you know, they're very knowledgeable. They bring an edge to the game that you have to learn how to play with. And that's why some guys don't like playing there. But you just learn how to deal with it. And pretty soon it's just become something that you're accustomed to and you really look forward to.
It's amazing because, you know, preparing for this interview, I just happened to mention to someone, you know, I thought that they were a Met fan. I said, you know, they said, well, they used to be. And I said, oh, because we're interviewing Hojo. And he said, Hojo? Oh, yeah. I mean, it's amazing to me how you just, I know that it's that era of Mets, yep. New York loves, but there are a few Mets, you, Keith, Gary, Yubi, Mookie, that just are loved in New York. I mean, if you would have run for mayor today, you'd probably win. Well, no, you would win because I don't think they love the mayor. But, you know,
it might be a little different up there if I was the mayor.
how was it playing behind those days when Doc Gooden and Ron Darling were on the mound?
Oh, it was awesome, especially when Doc was on the mound, because he was so dominant that when you were playing the field, it was almost like a day off. You know, you didn't get much action. Dave used to play me at short a lot in 86. And that was because Dwight was a fly ball, strikeout type pitcher. Same with Sid Fernandez. So there was never a lot of action. You know, you get a few games where you had some, but for the most part, you know, watching Dwight pitch from there was a treat, because you could see guys actually just get humiliated at the plate. And Doc was just, for that period he was there, there was none better. And if I had to pick, there's two guys that, if I had to pick two guys to win a game or they were going to kill me, it would be Dwight Gooden and Jack Morris. Those two guys are probably the best competitors I've ever seen.
Right.
Now, you were actually drafted as a pitcher.
Yeah, pitcher slash outfielder, and I didn't play either for the Tigers. I got the chance to go to spring training in 1979 and made our team in Lakeland, which is high A. I made the club and started out at shortstop. I was there about 3 weeks, and then they shifted me to third base. And my manager back in those days, Fred Hatfield, who passed away a few years ago, he used to tell me all the time, he'd go, "Hojo, you or Marty Castillo, you guys, one of you two is going to be the next third baseman of the Detroit Tigers." And I'm like, "Oh, I appreciate that, Fred. You know, I'm working hard at it, trying to make it happen." I think back then, even though when I was young, I didn't really see, you know, how I was going to develop. Somebody did. Somebody saw it and believed in it. And I was grateful that the Tigers kept me around and gave me an opportunity.
You know, you're only three hits away from 1,000 from big on the Mets. Your 10th hit for .997. Like, three hits.
Dang it. Well, that's too bad. I wish I could have got the 1,000 with that.
That would have been nice, yes. Let's talk about the World Series.
Eight more homers from 200.
That's true, yes. That's right, too. 192, exactly. 86, you win the World Series, obviously, but you're down 0-2, and you talked about your friend Bobby Ojeda.
Yep.
Going to game three. He pitched a hell of a game. And, you know, tell us about how that came about, that game.
Well, we had just come off a real grueling, emotional series against Houston where they were tough, you know, and we knew that going in. We didn't take them lightly. And we were able to come back and win kind of improbable. Didn't have to face Mike Scott in game seven. Figured out a way to win game six. And so that took a lot out of us. And going into the World Series, I think we just had a hard time reaching that emotional level that we needed to be at for the Red Sox, and they took it to us early. I remember we were in the tunnel leaving when the game was over. This game two was over. We lost, and we were in the tunnel. We were walking in, and the guys were all just kind of lined up, and we're just shaking hands like, "Hey, let's go. This is what we want. We want to go up there. We want to win. We want to be come back here and play, and we're going to win this thing." And so everybody was kind of unified at that point. And recharged emotionally and very ready to go to Boston and take on the Red Sox and try to win two.
And you did. And Bob pitched a hell of a game three.
Yeah, Bobby's a competitor, man. You give him an opportunity to close a team out, he's going to do it.
Yeah.
Hojo, just you win the World Series. I mean, I'm, of course, skipping a lot of stuff. We skip around a lot. But yeah. You're riding down the Canyon of Heroes. Describe that feeling. What is that like?
All I can think about was in watching the Mets when they won the World Series in 69, and they kept showing the video of the guys coming down the Canyon of Heroes, and all you can see is confetti and paper and just all whatever, balloons, everything was in the air. It was just a sea of white paper, something you just don't forget. You know, you picture it in your mind, it's in there forever. And that's what it looked like. It just was just amazing to see it. And then so many fans, you know, the whole city's out there basically at that point. They're happy for you. They're celebrating. And you're just happy to be a part of it. You know, you connect with the fans again, and you're celebrating the ultimate goal, which is the winning the World Series. And we won it such a crazy way. And just it was a remarkable season all the way through. And to finish it up like that was awesome. And then that parade was just the icing on the cake.
Besides Bobby, are you still in touch with some of the guys?
Yeah, I see Daryl. I see Daryl quite a bit. I talked to Straw. He's a pastor now and turned his life around, which is awesome. I've seen Dwight a couple of times. Occasionally, I'll text Tim Tuffle or Wally Backman. Mm-hmm. Dykstra, I hear from every now and then. But, yeah, guys, you know, we seem to kind of run into each other, you know, during the year. Not as much this year because of the virus stuff, but in the years past, we always seem to kind of connect.
Yeah, Backman is the manager of our local independent team out here, the Long Island Ducks.
Yeah, the Ducks, yep.
We also had Ed Hearn on the show not too long ago, and he was telling us about his experience going down to Canyon Heroes.
Yeah, I bet he enjoyed that.
He did.
We've actually had, it's funny, we've had a lot of catchers. We had Ed Hearn, Todd Pratt, Harry Lyons. We seem to have a lot of Met catchers on the show. So
they're supposed to be the smartest ones on the field. That's what the word is, right?
Right.
Except for the third baseman. The third baseman is brilliant.
That's right. Thank you very much, Leonard.
You're welcome. Hojo, I read something in a bio that when you were a kid, you would go to eat at Howard Johnson's.
Yeah, that's right.
And you would get a free meal.
Yep.
Right? Because of your name. So I made a joke today. I told someone, I said, it's too bad I didn't name my kids Peter Luger's or...
Oh, yeah, there you go. Now you're talking. I was in New York about a month and a half ago, and happened to get to go to Peter Luger for dinner before we left, and it was as good as I remember it. So good.
Speaking of, and like I said, we bounce around a lot, but I saw something else that you... A ribeye is one of your specialties that you grill?
Yeah, I love ribeye. That's my favorite meat to cook, my favorite steak. And you'd probably eat one of those every day if I had it in front of me. Yes.
We're going to talk barbecue at the end. That was a little tease.
Yeah. You got it.
A few more questions on the 80s Mets. 87 obviously was a down year, a lot of injuries. But you come back strong in 88, make a run for it in the playoffs. And I was at that game where Mike Schultz hit the home run. So, you know, I thought that might have been a better team than 86. I mean, you had such a great team.
Yeah, you could definitely make the case. Our pitching was much deeper that year. We should have won in 88. We played a Dodger team that we had beaten every game that year but one.
Right.
11-1 or 12-1 or something like that. Or I don't know. I forgot how many times we played them, but lost one game all year. And, you know, we felt good going into the series. You know, we just ran into Hershiser basically, and you know he was kind of the guy for them that year, and he took it right through us, right through Oakland, and won the series. And then we had opportunities to win, and things that never happened to us all year or against them at all were happening. You know, Osha, T-Bone Shelby, guys that were hitting homers that had not done so against pitchers that never gave them up. So it was just one of those things where we ran into a buzzsaw, and no matter what happens, when that happens, you just, it's hard to change the momentum of something like that when it's happening to you. But we gave it our best shot. We just couldn't get over the hump.
Yeah. And then the dark days come. I mean, 90s and 91, and, you know, Davies let go, Buddy Howson's let go. You have Jeff Torborg who played you in center field. I was looking at your stats there. You played every position but pitcher and catcher.
Yeah, I remember when Torborg got the job, and he called me, and he talked to me about going to center field and playing center field, and I thought, okay, I'll do it. You know, it was a challenge. I always loved challenges. It was later in my career. I was coming off a big season, and I thought, I'll do it. I would be more than happy to give it a shot. And so I spent that whole year really working hard on my outfield, and I think it made it maybe taking a toll on me offensively. It's hard to say, but I just had so much concentration on playing a good center field, and physically, I think it took a little bit too much out of me, more than I expected. You know, Shea's a big outfield; it's got big gaps, deep center field. Balls hang up there a lot, so you got to cover a lot of ground. I enjoyed it, but I just felt like if I was going to do that, make that switch, I think I should have done it earlier in my career when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
More physically, I probably could have done it, but it was starting to take its toll on me physically, and I just could never get over the hump physically to do it. And then eventually from center field, I went to left field or back to third base. Anyway, it was just, I was out there for a bit, and then they pulled the plug on it.
Right.
Yeah. It seemed a little strange because you were at third and you were getting a little older and your legs were starting to, you know, go a little bit.
Yep.
And then to put you in center, That is definitely an odd move. I mean, I'm not going to doubt, you know, Jeff Torborg. He knows more than I'll ever know. But it just seems a little strange that you would play a position like that.
I hadn't played outfield in a while. And, well, at the end of 91, I played the last month of the season in right field. So I was already kind of heading towards the outfield a little bit. And so to go to center, I think at that point, it was a challenge that I was willing to take. It was going to help our team, supposedly, and the makeup of the team, what he was looking at. And I felt like it was okay to go for it. You know, I never wanted to say, no, I'm not going to do something, you know, that's going to help our ball club. So, you know, I like Jeff, and I thought we talked about it. So it wasn't anything that, you know, I didn't agree with. I totally was on board with it.
Now, being a 30-30 guy, you know, that – a remarkable feat. You did it three times. The stolen base, and now that you're a coach, right, you've done a lot of coaching. Home runs, of course, now are everybody's hitting home runs.
Yeah.
But stolen bases, 30 stolen bases in a season now is like unheard of, it seems.
Yeah.
What is it about the stolen base that's, I guess because they're everybody wants to hit a home run, so they don't want to take a chance of an out? I mean, stolen bases is a lost art now.
Yeah, analytics kind of like killed it. I think they killed the walk and they killed the strikeout and they killed stolen bases. But the way I look at it is, even though the numbers are what they are and the way they explain things in analytical stuff, in analytical terms nowadays, the game is still the same. You still got to score more runs than the other guy. For me, nothing can beat pitching and defense. And if you could put pressure on the other team's defense with speed, then you can create runs when maybe their good pitching is on the mound, and they're not just going to give up home runs. You know, good pitching always beats good hitting. That's kind of like the rule of thumb. And sometimes you got to get creative. If you go up there, just keep trying to go for that pump all the time. And next thing you know, you've got, as a team, you've got like 12, 15 strikeouts and you got one run, you know, somehow. It's just, to me, it seems more baseball when it's, you got guys involved, there's pressure, pitchers got to worry about a guy stealing a bag, defenders got to worry about you running, defenders got to worry about making a good throw, bad throw or a walk with a guy that can run a little bit. You know, that's a walk, but that could turn into a triple. Certainly it could turn into a double. And you open up lanes in the infield when, you know, it eliminates a lot of shifts when guys are on base, when they're able to steal. So it's a big part of the game that's not being tapped. And somehow it's just gotten brushed aside as irrelevant. And I don't think it's that way. I just don't understand. I'm just not getting the reasoning behind it, why it's not important. I still think it's a lost art that can be taught. And I think if you ask opposing players on defense, would they rather have a guy out there swinging for the fences all or nothing, or a guy that can put the ball in play, run, maybe steal second, third base, you know, put pressure on you defensively? They'd much rather have that guy up there trying to swing for the fences because he can be pitched to.
Mm-hmm.
But once you create an opportunity to score with your legs, then – you know, you've done something. You've beaten that team without having to be a really, really good hitter.
Right.
Created opportunity.
As a coach, you mentioned the shift in analytics. As a hitting coach, it can't be just easy to say, just hit the ball the other way. I'm sure, I mean, it, from a fan's point of view, hit it, nobody's there, but it just can't be that easy. I'm sure you got to.
Yeah, it's really not, Jeff. I wish it was easy. I mean, if we're going to say, yeah, just hit the ball over there, then we should just say, well, just hit the ball in that gap where there's nobody standing.
Right.
And you'll get a double on every time you swing the bat. But you can't do it like that because the pitcher's got the ball. He's not going to allow you to do certain things. They want you to do certain things. You know, do I want Aaron Judge dropping a bunt down because they're giving it to him? Or do I want him swinging, you know, trying to hit the ball over the shift?
Right.
So it depends on what kind of makeup your team has. You know, and for me, speed kind of eliminates a lot of the shifts. It eliminates some of that stuff. You have to honor another facet of the game when you have speed in your lineup. And that's something like Houston has been really good at, okay? Whether they cheated or not, they still had guys that could get on base and run and create opportunities for easy RBIs. And you could score a run with a ground ball. Just it counts the same as hitting one out.
Right. And but to talk about hitting one out, does it really matter how if it goes 450 or 500 feet? As long as it goes over the fence, it's a home run.
Well, listen, Jeff, when I was playing, I was probably one of the smaller guys that could hit the ball out of the ballpark, you know. And I used to tell I never wanted to hit in the big group. Like BP, there's always four groups, right? So you get your first group, usually the starting pitcher and, you know, a couple of the extra men. And then the second group, you know, maybe another group of extra men. You know, the third group, you've got your, you know, middle infielders, your base hit guys. Then your last group's always the big bangers, right? The guys that are hitting the ball 9 miles in BP. I never wanted to hit in those big groups because I didn't want to be in that mindset when the game started. I was at my best when I was thinking just getting a base hit or, you know, hitting the ball hard the other way or hitting the ball hard up the middle. If I was trying to hit the ball out in BP, then I was going to be an out that day. So mm-hmm. I never wanted that to be something that I saw that I wanted to try to match. I was just very content to hit with Lenny and Wally and the other guys.
Hojo, back when you were hitting all these home runs, there were a couple of managers that liked to try and get in your head. I think what they were trying to do, right? Accusing you of using a cork bat. A few times that happened, they checked, they x-rayed, and every time it was negative. So what is that as you as a player? Does that make you play with a chip? Did it piss you off? I mean, what's your reaction?
I think in the beginning, I think you think that that's disrespectful. But at the same time, it's part of the game. I mean, there's guys that cheat offensively and defensively. I mean, pitchers cheat all the time. We saw in the Astros back in the 86 season, you know, they had guys busted all the time with sandpaper and stuff on them. You know, Joe Niekro got busted.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was a bunch of guys that got busted. We had Mike Scott. We had balls in our dugout. We had a bucket of balls from the game that Mike Scott pitched at Shea, and they were all scuffed in the same spot. I mean, you couldn't. I mean, it was so obvious. And so, for a long time, you know, guys did what they could do. You know, did what you could get away with. So that was still the mentality back then. So a lot of managers, what they would do is they would, you know, check you and. You know, they'd take my bat out of the game and they'd send it off to New York and get it x-rayed and then I get it back the next day, you know. So that's kind of what they did. And we had fun with it. Dave used to ask me, like, whose bat do you want to take from their side? So I'd always just say, get Will Clark's bat, you know, or get Kevin Mitchell, my buddy, you know, get his bat. Let's get Ryan Sandberg, get his bat. Andre Dawson, you know, all those guys. So you just kind of had fun with it. It was just one of those things where, you know, they're trying to rally you, but – you know, you can be much more mentally strong than that.
Yeah, Hojo, before we get to the barbecue portion, we're starting to read this book by David Wright. And he is glowingly talking about how you, one of his heroes, you know, his mentor. You know, tell us about your relationship with David Wright.
Man, I wish I could see this book. I haven't seen it yet. You know, David's like a son. You know, I have nothing but great things to say about that kid. I mean, I had him when he started out, and his agent, one of his agents is Keith Miller, who was an ex-teammate of mine. And Mills and I were always good, really good friends. We'd eat ice cream together after games and stuff and play cards and whatever. And so he called me one time. It was during Instruction League back in the early 2000s. And he said, hey, did you see that third baseman you guys got? I go, yeah, David Wright. I said, yeah, he looks pretty good. He goes, does he remind you of anybody? I said, why? Who should he remind me of? And he said, he's you. Because David Wright is basically you. And I said, wow. I said, okay. So then I really started watching the kid and fell in love with him, you know, his attitude and everything. And man, there's just I can still picture in my mind, you know, watching him out there. And so I was fortunate enough, and I want to say I was very fortunate to have him, you know, at every level, watched him develop, and he trusted me. And, you know, we shared a lot of things over the years. And to see him, you know, achieve what he's been able to accomplish is unbelievable for me. I mean, I'm super proud of the guy. And, you know, he's a great person, individual, big heart, wants nothing but the best, and he wants to win really bad. So I know he's got a lot of good things going for him.
Yeah, in the book he's talking about going through the minor leagues, and you're his mentor is just so much pride I'm sure you have for him.
It's I do, so I really do.
Yep. It's so funny that you mentioned Keith Miller, because my bowling partner, he's a big Met fan. He went to Frank Lewis High School. And I said to him, we're interviewing Hojo tomorrow night. And he was like, Hojo, that's great. And he started to tell me, first of all, he said, I grew a mustache just like him.
Nice.
And then he told me about how Keith Miller had moved across the street from him. One day comes with like a truck with all this Met stuff. And he sees him and he said something. And he said, where'd you get all the Met stuff or whatever? He says, oh, I play for them. So,
I know. He didn't look like a ball player, does he?
It's a small world, you know?
Yeah. It's a small world. It is a small world. Millsy's a great guy, though.
Yeah.
Great dude. Love Millsy.
So how did you get the barbecue? How did you get into all this grilling?
Well, let's see. I bought my first, well, my only smoker. I bought a Green Egg, big Green Egg. I bought it about 6 years ago. And started using it, didn't know anything about it, you know, didn't know anything really about YouTube researching recipes or anything. And I had some people that I knew, some guys that I knew with the Seattle Mariners. I was coaching in that organization at the time. And Alvin Davis is one of the guys over there. We've known each other a long, long time as well. And he's a big barbecue guy. And he used to share recipes with me. And he talked about it so much, you know, and I just like, man, that sounds like so much fun. So I thought, I'm going to get one and I'm going to start learning. I'm going to teach myself how to use it and just try to research it and talk to people as much as I could. I used to go down to Florida and do Tigers fantasy camp in January. And then during that same period of time in January, they had this big, big thing called Pig Fest. And it was out there in the parking lot of the stadium, and there was hundreds of tents, you know, and they're barbecuing, and they're having a competition. And so the guys I would just ask them, you know, I would just say, hey, how do you do your brisket? You know, how do you prepare your ribs? You know, what do you do? How do you do all that stuff? And they would show me, and they would teach me, and they would show me, you know, website to go to, or, you know, watch this guy or listen to this guy. Go talk to that guy down there. And they were so friendly. And I first thing that hits you with barbecue, it's such a tight community. And the people that are in the barbecue community are so friendly. And they're so outgoing, and they want to share everything that they have with you. It's not like they want to hold it and hide it. You know, they want to share. I've got recipes here from friends of mine that are big time, like competition barbecue guys, you know, like you guys. And they send me recipes and they give me recipes. And I'm like, look at them and go, wow, that's really awesome. You know, and I tell them what I do, and I tell them, you know, how I prepare this or how I prepare that, or the breakthrough I had when I was doing my first brisket. And, you know, it took me a few times to figure it out. And so, yeah, it just over the years, you just accumulate knowledge and you know, you get friends and, you know, it just becomes a thing to do.
Well, it's funny because we had on Doug Scheiding, who, super nice guy. He won the, you know, there's like major barbecue competition.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. So he won the Houston Rodeo, and I always tell people he didn't ride
the rodeo.
And so he represents Traeger, and he represents
Head Country.
And when we told, and he's a big Chicago Cubs fan. And when we told him that you were coming on and that you made a really good brisket, he said, find out his secret. Now, this is you know, a pit master. And what's your secret? So what's your secret to a great brisket?
My secret to a great brisket, what got me over the hump with a brisket is I started injecting it. And I never did before in the beginning when I did a brisket. Like, we've cooked briskets in the oven and stuff, and we didn't do that. And so I learned about injection, and I thought, man, I'm going to inject this thing like crazy. I'm going to mix up my broth. Okay. I got my ingredients, just do some things together. My wife makes a beautiful brisket for the holidays in the oven. And she uses Lipton onion soup mix as a base. And so I use that as my base when I do my briskets. And I use that with some beef broth and stuff. And I inject my brisket as much as I possibly can, and I try to, then I cook it and I take it off and I'll wrap it and I'll put some more stuff in there, more liquid in there. And then I just stick it back on there and I got to wait for it to get the temperature.
Nice.
And it turns out beautiful. And the other part that I learned that really like took one brisket I made, it was good. It made it great, was resting it and learning how to rest it for more than 2 hours. I rested one. I took it off. It was wrapped up. I took the moisture out and re-wrapped it up in foil, put it around my towels. I wrapped it up good, put it in a cooler. That thing was like a baby in there. And I kept it in there for about almost 3 hours and took it out, and it was still smoking hot. And by then, everything had broken down so good. And so by me injecting it and giving it those 3 hours of rest time, that's what did it. That's what put it over the top.
Yeah. A Yeti cooler, I think, is supposed to be really good for that. Ooh,
that's nice. I got to get it. I don't have a Yeti. I don't have a Yeti. I got a cheap one. I got a couple of cheap ones I use. They smell them up with barbecue.
That, and what else? Okay, so brisket, ribeye. Yeah. All right. When we come over to your house for dinner, when Jeff and I make our trip to Nashville, what are you making for us? If you're out of ribeye, you're out of brisket.
I'm making you baby backs.
Nice.
Pork loin ribs, baby. I'm going to make them up for you. So what I do is with those, it's all about taking them off the fire early. So they're on about an hour and a half, and then I take them off and wrap them, put them back on, let them get hot again. They stay on for another hour and a half or so. I don't even baste them at that point. Then I take them off. Okay. They're pretty much cooked at that point, but this now is where I'm going to start seasoning the meat a little bit. So I'll put a baste on there. I'll put some barbecue sauce on there. But what I like to do is I take butter and brown sugar, honey. So I put a lot of butter on it, smother that sucker in butter, in the foil, and then honey glaze all over it, and then a bunch of brown sugar. Wrap it up, stick it back on there for about a half hour, let it caramelize into the meat. Then I can take it off, and basically it's ready to go at that point. I can put some sauce on it and go for it.
That's so great. That sounds awesome.
The brown sugar is the big one.
Yeah, sounds delicious.
Yeah. Oh my gosh! And they taste like candy.
Uh-huh. So do you participate in any competition? Do you want to do that?
No, I've never done that, but I think it'd be fun to try. I mean, it depends on how much I have to cook of something. You know, like I've seen a lot of those competitions where they got a lot of meat out. You know.
Yeah.
And that's something that I'm not really accustomed to. That is like, you know, having a big slab of something out there, or, you know, just, I don't really know how to manage a lot of meat. I can just do my section. You know, I can do a brisket. I can do my ribs. I can do some pork, you know, some Italian sausage, pork sausage. I can do some of that stuff along with that. But, you know, to have like a whole lineup stuff, I don't know. That's a new thing for me.
I got to tell you, you said something about the barbecue community, and Len and I have been to a couple of competitions, and you are absolutely right. These people are the nicest people. Even though they're in competition, they want to share things with you. You're out of a sauce or out of a rub. Oh, come here, I'll give you this. You know, they're just so nice and want to share their knowledge with everybody. That's true.
It's the best. I mean, that's what drew me in also, is just the way people talk about their barbecue is so personal, you know. And they're willing to share it. They're willing to share their secrets. You know, Traeger's a great grill. I know a lot of my friends have Traeger grills. They love those things. You know, I've had my Green Egg. I was going to build my own barbecue. I was going to just try to like make it out of drums, you know. I passed on that. I decided I'm just going to go and, you know, splurge for the Green Egg and go for there. But yeah, I mean, I just love the fact that everybody's got their way of doing things. And I try to pick up on little stuff for everybody, you know. So if there's something you guys want to tell me, if you guys do, I would love to hear it because I want to try it.
Oh boy. I would
defer to Len because he's the more of the barbecue expert than I am. Okay. So I would defer to him.
All right. You know what, Hojo, I actually wanted to I wanted to bring on like a pit master and surprise you. And
oh man.
Another time, I think that's what we'll do. We'll ask
Let's
you
do
back
that.
On and we'll do
yeah, that. I would love that. I would yeah. love that.
You know, what I love, people say baseball and barbecue, and it's unique, but Like, we had on Greg Luzinski.
Yeah.
So, and you know he's a huge Bull. Barbecue yep. guy. Right, Bull's Barbecue yep. at Citizens Bank Park. It just goes together. It's like a Reese's, you know? It's yeah. the chocolate. It does. And it's amazing. What's really funny is we'll have people on from the world of barbecue.
Yep.
You know, a guy like we had a guy, Meathead, who's a huge barbecue guy. He's got a website, amazingribs.com.
Ooh.
If you wanna lose yourself.
Yeah, you'll lose yourself there.
Amazingribs.com. Okay. Check it out. Amazingribs.com, okay.
Yeah, he came on and I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, I had no idea he wanted to talk baseball. He starts off with baseball. I mean, that's what he wants to talk about. So it's so funny that, you know, people, oh, we had on Emily Detweiler from the Kansas City Bar.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know who her brother
yeah,
her husband, was?
Yeah, of course, yep.
Right? And so when we got in touch with her, she said, oh, great, I'm a baseball mom. And you know, baseball's such a big part of her family's life.
Yeah.
So the two, they just go so well together. I agree with you. It's the people are great, and it's just a nice thing. And our show is very unique. We get Hojo on. What other show has Hojo talking barbecue?
I'll tell you what, I appreciate it. And the site I like to go to, one of the guys when I was down in Lakeland at the Pig Fest, he said this guy named Malcolm Reed that said, How to Barbecue Right.
Yes.
That's the name of his site. And so I started watching him. And, of course, he's a big, big, heavy guy. And he's from the South. And so, you know, he loves his barbecue. And I just kind of liked his recipes and what he does with different grills. He uses all kinds of grills.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's been fun, man. I tell you, I love it. And I mean, my kids, they say, you know, make your ribs, make your pulled pork. You know, I'm good at that too. But so, yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah,
that's great.
The Big Green Egg is a great, because that's a Kamado grill. It's the ceramic. It keeps the moisture in. And you're right, the Traeger is a pellet grill. Jeff and I just started cooking on those, and we love it. I mean, so, you know, every grill has its purpose. And,
yeah, every grill is a little bit different. They have their purpose. You know, one thing I learned with brisket, too, was if I'm going to make it for, like, a real special occasion, you know, like maybe a holiday or something, then I'll go ahead and splurge on American Wagyu. I'll get a nice standard, you know, high standard, you know, meat, Wagyu meat that's got a lot of marbling. So I want that. I want that on my grill, you know, if I'm doing a real special thing. So that's always nice thing to do. If you want to, like, you know, go take another level, you know, I've learned a long time ago, just cooking hamburgers, that there's different levels of meat, you know, and if you put a good piece of meat on there and cook it, it's different. It's a different taste. And so even if you could take a bad piece of meat and cook it, it might not be the same. So it's okay, you know, to splurge on the quality of the meat, you know, on the front end, and it helps you on the back end.
Now, what kind of sauce are you making sauce when you make the ribs? Or
no, I just use like Sweet Baby Ray's. I just use some of that. I've got Rudy's barbecue sauce from Texas. I have some of that. There's a barbecue place in Jacksonville called Cotton's Barbecue. They have the best sauce I've ever had. The problem is I don't live in Jacksonville, and my son, for wherever make a trip through there, we pick up a bottle for each other, you know, and it doesn't last as long, you know, because everybody wants it. So yeah, Cotton's Barbecue is really, really good sauce. They make good sauce. I'd love to make my own sauce maybe one day.
Yeah, I tried. We have a guy, I think we mentioned, Ray Sheehan. He wrote a book.
Yep.
And he puts out Barbecue Buddha are his sauces. And I tried to make it, and it came out okay, but I think I like his, I don't know, there's something I'm missing, but I use bottled sauce. Blue's Hog is a very good sauce.
Okay, I've heard of that.
Yeah, and Head Country also are sauces. There's so many great ones out there, but Sweet Baby Ray's is good. Yeah.
It's a good grocery store one, you know. Not too bad.
Yeah, and you can always find it everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Put that with some Bush's baked beans on there, and you cook a nice sausage ring with that. Oh. And that way you got it all covered, man. It's the best.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Jeff, absolutely. Do you ask any more baseball questions?
I do, and I want to thank Hojo for taking the time. It's very generous of you. Just could you give us a couple of highlights of your career? What you were you most proud of?
Yeah, sure. Well, the 30-30s were big. I mean, the world championships are huge. I mean, I can't deny that. You know, a chance to win twice early on in my career was really special. I wish you could have won some more, but we didn't. But yeah, like the 30-30s, I never set out as a goal for that, especially in the beginning. I think after you do it one time, you know, it's like, okay, there's an old saying in baseball, anybody can do it once, you know? Anybody can do that one time. Like you do 30-30, you know, maybe he has 1 year in there, but, you know, can you do it again? And then it became, can you do it again? And so then you're in rare company when you can do it more than once.
Sure.
And then, of course, the home run and RBI title in 91, that was a big one for me because, you know, that's and being a switch hitter and being able to do it, that's not happened only but the one time that I did it. So that's pretty cool. You know, in the history of the National League, you've only had one switch hitter do that.
Yeah, that's great highlights. You know, Hojo, we really appreciate it. I just want to go down, just want to tell the people that you're in the top 10, you're third in stolen bases with the Mets with 202. You were fourth in home runs. Still, you know, this is, you know, since the 80s. We're in 2020 now. It's still up there. Top four in RBI, 629. You're fourth in walks, fourth in run scores, fifth in doubles. It's incredible. And you still loved up here, man. You still are.
Well, I appreciate it. I love New York too, man. I have a lot of friends up there still. And I look forward to the days I can go up there. And hopefully when this virus ends, I can get back to Shea Stadium, Citi Field, and see everybody.
Well, we hope to see you out there, and we really appreciate you taking the time. And you're still coaching, right?
Yeah, I was going to coach last year in Mexico. Uh-huh. So I don't know what this year is going to bring, but yeah, before that I was with the Rangers organization.
Right.
Yeah, it's a new chapter right now.
All right, well, best of luck to you. We really appreciate you taking the time, and all the best.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff, Leonard, I appreciate you guys. You're awesome, all right?
Thank you.
Wow.
Oh, I love Hojo.
He was terrific.
He was absolutely terrific.
Yeah.
Very personable, very friendly. Love talking to him.
You know, Jeff, somebody told me that because when we had Tim Kirchen on, and I mentioned to a friend of mine, I said, we spoke to him and we were in awe that we're speaking to Tim Kirchen. And he said to me, what I love about your show is that number one, you guys are fans and you don't hide that fact. And you know what? We don't. We are fans. And Hojo, big part of our Met fandom. He'll always be a Met to us.
Yes. And if you'd like to contact the show, give us a call, 516-855-8214. Check us on our Facebook page, Baseball and BBQ. Instagram, Baseball and Barbecue, or Barbecue's all spelled out. We have our YouTube page. We have our website, www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com.
We got to finish the show, and we're going to finish it with the poet and the musician. We've got Dave Dresser, Shel Krakowski with Baseball Always Brings You Home. Bonus episode's over, but we'll see you next time, guys, for episode 81.
And that's going to be a big one, too. See ya.